We're on Psalms 98, that's Tzadik Ches, verse 1. It says, Psalm to God, a new song because of the wonders that he did. To him his salvation is his right hand and his holy arm. All right, that's just the metaphors about God. Okay. Verse 2. He makes known his salvation to the eyes of the nations. He reveals his righteousness. But it means he makes known his salvation. He makes it known at first through the prophets. In other words, through prophecy, you know that it will happen. And then he says, then he carries it out in the eyes of the nation, then everybody sees it. So you see, the idea of justice in this world is not only for the Jew, not only for Klal Yisrael, but it's also for everybody to see. The only thing is some people see it through prophecy and they recognize, because they know prophecy. Some people have to wait for it actually to happen. Okay? That's verse 2. Verse 3. He remembers his kindness and his faithfulness to the house of Israel. And they see, and all to the end, they see to all the ends of the world the salvation of our God. In other words, they see it through Israel, the way God relates to Israel. In other words, the relationship of God to Israel as a nation is basically good and evil. Okay? Now, you might not be able to see it today because there's a certain time where God turns his back on Israel, and then he totally leaves us in the laws of nature. But that's a act of punishment. It is an act. It's not like just that you're in the laws of nature, like an animal. He's just in the laws of nature. We're always under God's supervision, but however, sometimes when we're at the lowest, the supervision is such that God says that you must live in the laws of nature. So that's why it says that his salvation for our God, that they see to the ends of the earth the salvation of Israel. And you could also see it, by the history of the Jew. The history of the Jew is unique, and was pointed out by Mark Twain, that basically all the nations were the most powerful nations in the world that tried to destroy Israel, and they don't exist anymore in that glory. I mean, the country exists, but they don't exist with that glory anymore. But Israel is still existing, still moving on. Okay, the question is, what good is being punished in the laws of nature? You don't know what you're being punished for, okay? There are two ways that you can know what you'd be punished for. Either you have prophecy, basically by the first base of Migdash we had prophecy about the destruction and the sin that we were doing. After that, through the study of Torah, through understanding, you could give a certain probability. If you don't have prophecy in a particular situation, a particular time in history, and so therefore you don't exactly know what is the cause of the sin, then through study of Torah, you could define a certain probability of what is the sin that is causing us to stay in exile. Right. The thing that first you have to do is first you have to learn how to define yourself to know where your mistakes lie and why you have either consequences in the laws of nature or in Hashgacha Pratis and God's personal supervision. But once you know that, then you could define a group. Like a classroom has a certain personality. One person goes out or a certain person comes in, many times it can't change the chemistry, and the personality of the class changes. It's a difference. So you have to, it's a study that you have to study to know how to define what your sin that you did, what's wrong, why you, well, what's wrong, and what you have to do to change it. That is a study. It's not an automatic thing, but you can know it. But you will not know with the certainty of prophecy. You can only know with the high probability of a person that studies and makes a decision. You can never know 100% why Klal Yisrael or Israel is in exile. You can only know with a high probability. Verse 4, call out to God all the land and open your mouth and with song and music. Sing to God with or play music to God with a kinar. Kinar is an instrument with the kinar and the sound of song. With trumpets and the sound of the shofar, you should call out before God the king. Most of the commentaries say that this is will be at the time of the Mashiach, the time of Messiah. This people will recognize it, and we'll soon get to the essence of what I think the essence is here. Yiram Hayam, the rivers roar, umaloo, and fill up. Tevel, the world, Beosheva, and all that dwell in it. Okay? Nahoros, the rivers clap their hands together, the mountains sing. These are all metaphors, okay? But anyway, I think the last verses were the essence. It says, L'fnei Hashem, before God, they should do all these things. They do all these things before God. Why do they do all these things before God? Kivo lishpo ta'aretz, because he's come to judge the land. When coming to judge the land, that means God's personal supervision. It's not the laws of nature, but God is coming with his personal supervision to judge. Yishpot tevel b'tzedek. He judges the world with righteousness, v'amim and the nations v'meshorim with fairness. Okay? The commentary says, what is righteousness and fairness? At that time, at the time of the Messiah, only the wicked will die and the righteous will not. It's not just a chance happening that, you know, who dies. It's not the laws of nature. God will decide, and the punishment will be against the wicked and not against the righteous. Okay, we're going to do Perek Tzadik Hei. That's 95. And the essence of the whole chapter, the first thing that we should do is verse Yud. That's 10. Okay, and it says, Arbom Shon Okut Bedar, for 40 years I loathed the generation, this generation of the desert. But Omar, and I said, Am Toei Lev of Haim, this is a nation that has an erring heart. And they do not know my ways. So the question is, what's the difference between an erring heart and they do not know my ways? So the Sefuno says, he says like this. He says, Toei Levav is where they have wrong, incorrect ideas that they got from the nations. Okay, that they got ideas from the nations, different ideas from the nations that were in error. And they don't know my ways means that they don't have rational proofs, just like I wrote, they don't have rational proofs. And then he quotes a pasuk from Shemos that says that I wrote to guide you, okay, or I wrote to instruct you. So the thing is, he says that you should have rational proofs. So there's two mistakes, that you learn from the nations and you don't have rational proofs. Okay, you see, most of the ideas when people start out, they start out with ideas that they pick up from the society around them. of the nation around them, society around them, they pick up certain ideas. But however, that has to be changed through rational proofs. They didn't take those two steps. With that introduction, from verse 10, I think we could do the chapter. Okay, it says, "Luchu Naran Na Lashem." Go and sing to God. And everybody says that Luchu, the Radak and the Metzudas Tzion, says that Luchu, or the Metzudas David, says that Luchu means to, with zeros, with energetically. Should energetically and with strength, that you should drive yourself to sing to God. Now, there are two types of motivations that motivate people to be, and the opposite of laziness is ambitious and zesty and energetic, okay? So they say you should do this energetically or ambitiously. You should sing to God, okay? Now, there are two causes that causes a person to be ambitious or energetic or zesty. There are two things that that cause it. One is you're raised in a certain society and you accept the values of society, and they're very important to you, the values of society. So therefore you are driven and energetic about that. Now that we saw from verse 10, that's not what the Torah is talking about. Your ambition must be as a result of your knowledge and understanding. Okay, even in religious matters, when you start out with religion and you keep the Torah, you keep the Torah because you were raised that way, and even if you are energetic about studying Torah and working in Torah, there has to be a change. That's a lo lishma, an incorrect motive. There has to be a change from being energetic even about the right thing. The motive has to change from the personal that you were, from the way you were raised, from the way you were raised, to, it must be changed to the rational and intelligent, with, like this Furno says, with proofs and understanding that this is the correct way, but not to accept it because I was raised that way. It says in Tefillah, it says, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. So why does it say the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? It should say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why does it have to say the God of each one individually? Even though Isaac and Jacob were raised in the household of Isaac was raised by Abraham and Yaakov was raised by Isaac, but each one found God. Even though they were raised that way, but they had to find it by themselves, and each one found God on his own with his own thoughts to see it on himself, and therefore the motivation, what motivated you originally, changes, and now what motivates you is the world of ideas. Go and sing to God and shout to the rock of our salvation. And you should, nekadma means you should be early, meaning also a type of being energetic before him in thanksgiving, and with song you should call, scream out to him. Why should you do all these things? Because he is a great God, and he is a great God on all other gods. Okay? In other words, he's greater than all other gods. And now the question is, what are other gods that we're talking about? Okay? So the thing is that there are two ways of relating to God. One is emotionally, there's a need for religion. The source for religion basically is that people, the physical world is a very insecure place. I mean, anything could happen. You know, a tennis ball could hit you in the temple, hit you in the right place in the temple, and you could get a blood clot and die. You know what I mean? Like, there's never any real security in any given moment. There is no real security in the physical world. Okay? So therefore, people, because of their fear of reality, so they turn and they create a god that will give them the security that they need to live through this reality that's very scary. Okay? People have neuroses and all types of things that they cover up their fear of reality, and they remove it in many, many different ways. It's if you actually saw reality, dark. I mean, it's very hard. It's a slow training that you get used to it. Start facing the problems of reality. Okay? So, the thing is that, but by God, like we said before, it must be based on ideas. We cannot create a God because to satisfy our emotions. That cannot be a real God. So what we have to do is we have to find God in reality, you see? So when it says that he is greater than all the gods, it doesn't imply that there are other gods. It implies he's greater than any god that you can create, that you can create. That's what he's greater. Because in your mind, in other words, the King David is talking to our emotions, and the emotions hold there are powers, unbelievable powers in the physical world that you feel security. People feel security with family. People feel security when they're in a society, when they're in a group. They have a certain security. People find their security in many different ways, which is not real. Real security is first comes, you must first recognize and accept the weakness of reality, and then find God rationally, not to create him, but to find out exactly who God is and exactly how he relates to you. And it's that knowledge that will show you that he's really greater than all the other gods, because the other gods that you've created will really not help you at all. There's no help at all. But with the real God, there are ways, but it must come through, like the Sifuno says, must come through knowledge and understanding and proofs and ideas. Then he explains about this God. He says that it is in his hands the depths of the earth. In other words, the very deep parts of the earth that people cannot see, that you can only imply and understand. And also the highest mountains. It's all in his hands, his ability. And you must see that, not just accept it because King David is saying, but you must see it clearly, this idea. And to him is the sea, and he made it, and the dry land his hands formed. Water and dry land is, in other words, they made two subdivisions. One is the core of the planet Earth, and then the outside, and then the highest mountains. And then they subdivided it between the dry land and the water, which he formed, like it says in the Bereshis, that the water covered the earth, and then he made the waters be in certain places. Okay? Now, when you recognize this, then come and bow and prostrate yourself and bless and be blessed before God, our Maker. Okay? Because he is our God, and we are his because he is our God, and we are his nation, the flock of his nation, and the sheep of his hand. If today in his voice you will listen to him. Okay? In other words, we become God's flock and his nation when we listen to him. Okay? So as the Matzudas Bevet says, that just like a shepherd guides the flock to pasture and to help them and guide them and take care of them, And if one of the sheep gets lost, he goes after them. I mean, so God protects us and takes care of us on one condition. We listen to his voice. That's the only condition, that if we listen. Okay, and like we said before, listening to God means through knowledge and understanding and proofs. Then he says in verse 8, don't harden your heart like Meribah, like the day in Massa in the desert. These were two places where the Jews rebelled against Klal Yisrael. I mean, the Jews rebelled against God, okay? They did something against God. Question is, what does it mean, harden your heart? What does it mean, harden your heart? What does harden your heart mean? Again, there's two types of stubbornness, okay? Harden the heart means stubborn. There's two types of stubbornness. There's one type of stubbornness that's part of a person's personality, that he is stubborn and he doesn't give in no matter what. Like a rebellious person. If you tell him to do X, whether it's good or bad, it doesn't matter. He can't do it. Okay? It's like very, it's stubborn. Right? But then there's a stubbornness that you close your mind to reality. In the Torah, when they use the word stubborn, okay, or harden your heart, it means you close your mind to reality. You don't let yourself see the truth or the ideas. Says, don't harden your heart. In other words, if you were, like it's going to say in verse Yud, like let's say, like the Sephorno said in verse Yud, that the errors that you make is that you learn from the society around you, and once you learn these ideas and this lifestyle, so you close your mind, that becomes like your security, and then you close your mind to any new idea because it's very insecure. Therefore, he says, God is above all the gods. God is the real God. What you're hanging on to is something false. And you're being stubborn and holding on to something because of a false security that you feel you're afraid to see something new. People are afraid to see something new that will change their lives. They're very frightened of that. You see? So therefore, they're afraid to open their mind to these ideas. You say, so what he's saying is, don't harden your heart. The reward is great. God will really take care of you. God's personal assistance will come. You'll see the true ideas, and that will be the real security. That's the real security that can really help you in this world. The other one is just a fake out, and there's no real help. There's no real help. It's like they say about the ostrich. He sticks his head in the dirt. Like he doesn't want to see reality. Okay? It's a metaphor for not seeing reality. Now, the thing is that a lot of people don't want to see the truth because they feel that they're afraid of change, because change, they feel very insecure. And that's a dangerous thing. That's hardening your heart. You see? That is hardening your heart. We're afraid to see the truth. Pasuk test. That's 9. That your forefathers tested me. What does it mean they tested me? They tested me to see if, you know what I mean, like they did the wrong thing. I don't know if they tested God like consciously, but they went against God to see what God would do. That's even after they saw all my actions, all the miracles, they still didn't trust in me. And they still like tested me to see what I could do and how far I'll go. So the thing is that we're back to verse 9. It says in the desert that your forefathers tested me, and they also tested me, even though they saw my actions. Tested me means that they didn't trust. Test means that I really don't know if you know it, or in this case, I don't know if you can do it. So therefore, they tested God to see if he could do it. They didn't trust him with the water or whatever their complaints were. They did not trust him. That was the test. And that was after they had proof that he could do it. But one thing is if you first meet God and you don't have proof yet, so you don't know what he could do. But here they saw what he can do. Then we come to the verse that we started with, and that's for 40 years I loathed this generation, and I said that they are that they make mistakes, a nation that makes mistakes, because according to the Sephorno, they err in the they follow the society, and they do not know my ways. They do not have proofs, and they should have proven all these things. They don't act based on proofs and knowledge, but they base their decisions based on their feelings. Here we have proof, and they didn't live by this proof, so therefore they deserve to be punished. But however, and what did they live by? They lived by their the way they were raised, their emotions, and the society they lived in. And then he ends off that I swore with in my anger that they will not come to the place of my rest, which means Eretz Yisrael. That was the consequence of their actions. Okay, as a result of that, the consequence was that they couldn't go into Eretz Yisrael. We're doing chapter Tzadik Vav, that's 96. And it says, sing a song to God, sing a new song, song to God, all the earth. The question is, why is it a new song? In the last verse, that's 13 of this chapter, it says, before God, because he comes to judge the earth, he judged the world with righteousness and the nations with trustworthiness. So the essence of the chapter is that God comes to judge the earth. Question is that God is always judging the earth. The answer is that God, there's two ways that God judges. One is that you see openly that the good are successful and the evil people are destroyed. And it's so obvious that you cannot deny that God is involved in the physical world. But at other times, because of the sins of Israel, so then God hides himself, and wickedness is successful, and the Jews are downtrodden, you see. So we don't see, it's not obvious that God is totally involved. The very wise know that God is always involved, but however, the people that do not live by ideas, and so therefore it's not real to them, these ideas, so therefore they do not see the truth that God really governs the world at all times. Because that, when God is not actually carrying out, making the good successful and the wicked fail, so when God doesn't do that, so then you can only know it with chachma. But with your five senses, you can only see it at certain times. So it's like a new thing for the person that does not see God's justice through chachma. So then when it happens, it's like a totally new thing. That's the basis of the whole chapter. So sing a song to God and bless his name, and they will tell from day to day, they will tell on the news his salvation. The nations will tell about his glory and all the nations his wonders. Because God is great, he's extremely praiseworthy. Noruhu akol Elohim, he is awesome. Over all the gods, meaning by gods it means that there's a certain feel. It's a idolatry. So when you recognize the true God, then you have to recognize that he is in reality, and the others are all just a big fake. So therefore, he's above all the gods in your own mind. Really, the comparison. Really, there's absolutely logically. There is no comparison, but the comparison is only in our mind, where we see the truth about God, and so then the false gods that are in our mind just disappear. That's what it means, he's above all the gods. Because all the gods of the nations are nothing, and God, he made the heavens. Okay, in other words, he's part of reality. They are nothing. They're just based on your fantasy, on the way you look at your incorrect view of life. So you see certain things as gods, or in your own mind, or certain things outside you. You give powers to that are beyond reality. So it's really equal to nothing. That's why they call them nothing. But however, God is the source of all reality. He made the heavens, meaning he's the source of all reality, and that's how he is above all the other gods. Okay? Hod v'hadar, that's glory and majesty is before him, and strength is the beauty of his holiness. Give to God, let all the families of the earth give to God honor and strength. Give to God honor and honor his name, and bring a sacrifice and come to his courtyards. That means the Beis HaMikdash or the temple. Bow to God in the beauty of his whole, in his Beis HaMikdash, and tremble because of him. Let all the earth tremble because of him. In other words, when you see the truth, so then you'll tremble because of the truth. The nations will say that God reigns, and he makes, he has established the world, and it will not move. Okay? It will not, in other words, you can't change anything. And then they will really, they'll truly see that idea based on the fact that God controls the laws of nature, by the fact that only the righteous will be successful and the wicked will fail, and he judges the nation with righteousness. And the heaven, these are metaphors that the heaven, meaning about, relates to people. The heavens will be happy, and the earth will rejoice, and the rivers will roar when it's full, and the fields will be joyful and all that's in it. Then they will sing, all the trees of the forest will sing. These are all metaphors, and it means before God, because he's coming to judge the earth. In other words, everything will work correctly. The whole world will work totally based on good and evil. He'll judge the world with righteousness and the nations with his trustworthiness. That ends chapter 96. Well, we're in Proverbs chapter 2, and what we have so far is that if you have a commitment to learning based on your ideas, that commitment will bear fruit. Okay, if you have a commitment based on some emotion, then that commitment might last and might not last. Okay? Now, then he says that knowledge comes from God. In other words, it's a natural law, the law of nature, that if you are committed, that you will get the fear of the Lord. Okay? Because God hides for the Yashurim. Yashur is a person that thinks correctly. That's a clear thinker. He gives them independent thought. According to the Ibn Ezra, the word Tushia means independent thought, and he is a shield for those that walk in perfection. By perfection, he means that your emotions are in line with your ideas. And then God guards the ways of justice, and the ways of his chassidav he guards. So the Ibn Ezra points out the same level that God guards the ways of justice, in other words, where he gets involved and where he doesn't get involved, is the same way that he gets involved with his chassidav. It's a certain level of development where God relates to you because you are guided by the ideas of Torah. Okay? Now, when you reach that level, now it starts telling all the benefits of learning. Then you will understand righteousness, justice, straightforwardness, and all the good paths, all the good roads. All these things are defined better later on in different verses. They're better defined by the verses. Because when Chachma comes into your heart and knowledge is sweet to your soul, okay? Mizimo Tishmar Lecha, ideas will protect you, and understanding will also, it's a protection. In other words, they protect you. Now, what does it protect you from? It's going to protect you from the path of evil and from people that speak opposites. In other words, they try to fake you out and fool you. It protects you from those type of people. In other words, you'll be able to protect. In other words, many times you are fooled by people. People talk you into things. For instance, in many different things, there's politics, there's philosophy, there's what is justice. All the many, many ideas that you read, a lot of them sound good, but they're not necessarily true. And so therefore, they speak untruths, and if you reach this level, you'll be able to protect yourself and be able to recognize the difference between true and false, because your mind will be trained, your emotions will be in line with these ideas, and you will desire to see these ideas, and you'll be able to see clearly. The emotions won't stop you from seeing clearly the falsehoods. Those are people that leave the path of straightforwardness, of thinking clearly, to go in the road of darkness. The idea of darkness is an interesting metaphor that in his book, the Chovos HaLevavos, Duties of His Heart, says that if you're in a room where you were never there and it's totally pitch dark, and you don't know where the furniture is, you will bang into different places. But however, if you have a flashlight, even a small light, then you won't bang into these things. You'll be able to see through the darkness. You'll be able to see not to fall, not to bang yourself. So he says that the ideas of Torah, that's the flashlight that will guide you through the world of darkness. Because the thing is, when you look at the world superficially, there's a lot of superficial ideas there. Like, you just see it superficially, it's not the real depth. That, but when you see it with a trained mind, then you're able to see beneath the surface, and you will not be faked out and fooled by these ideas. That's the metaphor of darkness. These people are happy to do evil. They look at evil and say it's a wonderful thing. Their happiness and their confusion and their contrariness, insofar as their evil is concerned, contrariness to the world of ideas, to the world of truth, because of their darkness, they don't recognize their own wrong ways, and it goes on, that their ways are crooked and their paths are also false. Okay? Now listen to what he says. He says, and if you go in the way of the world of ideas, it'll also save you from a strange woman and from a foreign woman that her words are very smooth. By a foreign woman, some people learn it literally, they're talking about a prostitute. But some people talk about that it's talking about a philosophy or an idea that is smooth, that sounds good to the emotions, and it draws you in to their way. They leave the path of their youth for this, And the by the path of the youth, it clarifies in the second half, and the covenant with their God they forget. In other words, their original covenant with God, their understanding of truth, then that is forgotten by all these false philosophies. And this all happens because you are not trained. If the mind is not trained, you are faked out by a lot of things. Okay? That is... he says in verse 18, because he turns to her house turns to death, and death is all her path. In other words, when you go to these foreign ideas that are different than the ideas of Torah, so then that leads to death. Now, by death, there's two types of death. There's death that's natural, where a person lives out his life and he dies. That is not wrong. In fact, the Rabbah points out by the later prophets, they say that he prophesies during the lives of, and it mentions the kings that he prophesies during. And you'll see they live, most of them live through the lives of four kings, some three. I remember one was even five kings. In other words, he tried to point out that they live a long life. You live out your life. Even though there was a prophet named Shmuel that he only lived 52 years, it seems that that was his genes. Like there's no miracle of living longer than you're supposed to, even for Samuel. His genes, that was his genes, that he lived for 52 years. That's what the Torah is telling us when they say that he lived for 52 years. But because they lived a just life, they did not have conflicts, and they didn't pay consequences for their lives. They were guided by truth. So then therefore they lived out their lives according to their genes, what their genes dictate. But if you don't live a correct life, I mean, you could tell, like for instance, in the United States, the three biggest professions is doctors, lawyers, and psychiatrists. So we see that there's something wrong in the way we live our life, that there's terrible conflict, and conflict definitely shortens your life. So that, when it talks about death, doesn't only mean death. It means that your life is worthless. I mean, you live in conflict, and you have terrible, terrible consequences. So that's what he means by death. So he says, if you don't live the life of truth, so then that will happen. All that come into it, to this life of falsehood, where they're not guided by the world of ideas, but that to ideas that are they're drawn to by their emotions, they will never return, and they will never understand the ways of life. The true, they see a false view of life, and they will never get to the true view of life. So that you should go in the way of good and the path of the righteous, it will protect. That's talking about the world of ideas, that it will protect you. Because the people that think straight, the Yisharim, the people that think straight, will dwell in the land. And the Tamimim, those are the people that their emotions are in line with their ideas, will satisfy all their needs. But the wicked from the land will be cut down because of their false ideas. By cut down, they'll be cut down, as we explained, and the rebellious means rebellious against reality, will be ripped out from their place. In other words, they will suffer the consequences of their evil lives. So what he's saying in general, that the consequences for not having a commitment to the world of learning. And by a commitment, I don't mean that you have to learn 18 hours a day. It means that you recognize the life of learning and you're drawn to learning, depending each according to their abilities. They put in all their energy into learning. They will, and the book later on, especially after chapter 10, will show you in detail the consequences that he's talking about here in a general way, He will show you different acts and different things, how it affects you. That ends chapter 2. We're doing chapter 28, verse 18. He who walks in perfection will be helped, and he who has crooked ways will fall in one of them. The perfected person, the person that follows the straight and narrow path, he walks on that path, will be helped. He will be saved. And he who walks a crooked way will fall in one of them. The question is that if somebody is perfected, then he doesn't need help. What does it mean he will be saved? What does it mean? He is perfected. In other words, Akiva's question is that the righteous person, the perfected person, will, by the way he operates, there will nothing go wrong because he operates according to his mind. The person that goes the crooked path, then one will be able to think correctly and know how to deal with the situation. Even though he's put in a very bad situation, he knows how to deal with it. But the person that walks a crooked road, which means he doesn't think correctly, so he thinks in many incorrect ways, he'll fall in one of them. That's why it says he'll fall in one of these ways in which he operates, because you never know. I mean, since he has many different ways, the way he's going to operate in that particular situation will cause him to fail. You see, he'll fall in one, whatever he decides is probably the wrong way. So therefore, we're not talking about how you make decisions or how you think. We're talking about how you make decisions if you're in trouble, not what gets you into trouble. Okay, that's the explanation of the process. Well, conversely, many things could go wrong in life, so therefore he could fall in one of them, any one of the things that could fail, because he doesn't know how to operate in those situations, he will fall in one of them. We're doing chapter 28, verse 19. It says, he who works his ground will be satisfied with bread, and he who runs after emptiness will be satisfied with poverty. All right, the first question is what does it mean he chases emptiness? What is emptiness? And also, what is the term, and he's satisfied with poverty? I mean, that's a funny way of expressing it. I mean, just say, oh, have poverty. Poverty. What do you mean be satisfied with poverty? And we'll go according to Ken. Emptiness means when it is not practically working. The ground represents practicality, right? So emptiness is where you're going after something that is of no value. Like, for instance, if a person goes after money beyond greed or stinginess, where he works for money beyond what he needs, or he saves money beyond what he needs, and he just keeps going, and it's just the greed. So the thing is, that's the emptiness. He's not working for anything practical. Okay, working the ground is a practical thing. There's an interesting medrash that says that Alexander came and he was going to fight with the Amazons. So anyway, they decided not to fight, and the Amazons bring him gold. And he was hungry, so he says, what good is the gold if I need bread? So he says, you mean you came all the way over these mountains to Africa just to get a little bread? You see, in other words, you run after all this. Alexander represented adventurism, going out and conquering, you see. But it was all a fantasy, so the Chazal used it as a metaphor, saying, what are you running after? You know what I mean? All you really need is the basic thing, but beyond that, just running after nothingness. The question is, what do we mean by basics? I mean, I'm not saying that you shouldn't enjoy certain emotional things. I'm saying, let's say you enjoy a nice house, you enjoy nice things. But however, when it starts going beyond, like, yeah, let's say, for instance, people like to go shopping. They always need new. It's not the object, it's the desire for the newness, you see? So they're never really ever satisfied. In other words, they're running after, it's not a practical thing. You have to distinguish between that which is usable, that because I need that particular thing, or where that particular thing represents a certain fantasy, but it's not the object which I'm really interested in. So the thing is, if you're right, in other words, when you try but keep buying the new, you're just satisfied for the moment. But in the long run, you're not satisfied. The way to deal with it is to deal with that emotion. Find out what that emotion is and try to deal with that emotion. But to try to satisfy it in the physical world, that it'll never be satisfied. I think that's what it means, that he's satisfied with poverty. Because he just has, for the moment, he's satisfied, like in the case where he needs new things, so he's satisfied. Or a greedy person makes a big deal, he's satisfied for the moment. But he's really never really satisfied. He's really always in poverty. Poverty means a person that's in need, constant need, you see. He is satisfied with the same emotions as a poor person. Poor person is not satisfied because he doesn't have the practical. He's never satisfied because he could never satisfy his fantasy. So he's satisfied with poverty. That's what it means. Satisfied with poverty means that he is the poor man because he's never satisfied. He's no different than a poor person. Okay, Pasuk Chaf, that's 20. All right, we'd like to talk about the three levels of a chacham, a wise person, a tzaddik, a righteous person, and a chassid. The chassid comes from the word kind, the kind person. Okay? Right, we say that there are, that the development of a human being is based on his motives, and through knowledge you could change your personality. So therefore, you must always start with, you must always relate to your personality and live by your personality, okay? Now, the first stage is a person is selfish. Every human being is driven by two desires, according to Sadhya Gaon, and that is a desire for pleasure and avoidance of pain, okay? But most people, there's two ways of looking at pleasure and pain. There's immediate pleasure and pain and future pleasure and pain, consequences of your actions. So therefore, an evaluation always has to be made between the immediate of pleasure and pain and the future pleasure and pain. The difference between a chacham and another person is the desires are the same. They both desire to avoid pain and have the most amount of pleasure, but the chacham does it in an intelligent way. The fool, what Shlomo HaMelech calls the fool, he only does the immediate pleasure or avoids the immediate pain, but he doesn't think about the future. Chacham trains his mind to evaluate the immediate plus the consequences or results of his actions. So that's the chacham. As you continue your studies, then either through Gemara or through Mishlei, you can become a tzaddik. A tzaddik is a person. See, the chacham recognizes that there is a system, and he uses the system for his own benefit, for his own pleasure. The tzaddik recognizes that he is part and parcel of the system. He recognizes, just like a star to Einstein was only a means of understanding the system. The star in itself had no meaning. So he too recognizes that he's just part of a social system, and therefore he is part and parcel of the system. That, in other words, through Gemara and Mishle, you can reach the level of Tzaddik. However, there's another level that comes through Tehillim, and the subject of Tehillim is God's personal hashgacha, God's personal supervision, and a lot of the laws of nature and how to look at the laws of nature, certain view of the laws of nature. It says when you study these two subjects, then what happens is you get involved with the individual person. In other words, you try to understand through the understanding of human beings, the understanding of psychology, the needs of a human being, understand the needs of a human being, and try to help that human being. That's why you'll find the term chassid found in Tehillim and Psalms. Now, how that works is, I believe it works like this. The thing is, either you accept a God, or a true God, you accept the false God, or you don't accept the God. Okay? If you don't accept the God, so then the truth is it doesn't matter if whatever happens to you, you're no different than a germ. I mean, just an accident, a chance accident of nature. And so therefore, there's no reason to care for anybody else, or for yourself for that matter, because it's just a chance happening. If you have a false God, then your morals and ethics are simply, since the whole thing is projection, so your whole demand on yourself, what your morals and ethics are, is only your own creativity. You created it, and it's nothing else but that. But if you find through the mind a true God, you see, and you recognize that there is a true God, then the world must have a purpose. Then that purpose must be and you see, especially through Torah, you see that purpose is to deal with the individual, because you see that God, on the personal level, deals with the individual. So the thing is that is part of the plan, that you should help the individual. That's why they use the term chassid. You must go in order. You have to first become a chacham, then a tzaddik, and then the chassid. Okay? The question is, there are people that are nice that are not wise. Okay? The answer is that niceness... the thing is that there are... that if you'll notice that, let's say for instance, people go to a motel and they'll take a towel without asking, or other things they'll steal. Okay? Now the reason why they could do that is because they could bypass their guilt. You see? Because the society accepts that this is like there's nothing wrong in that. In other words, you see, it's not thought out, it's what's acceptable to society. See, a person is evil, but the only thing is, he has the ability to be trained, so his training controls his evil. So it depends on what frame. I'll give you another example. Most teenagers think they're nice. But however, if I never heard a teenager say, when there is a substitute or a weak teacher, say, well, this teacher can't control the class, so let's be nice to him. You understand that's never going to happen. Not only that, there's many students that brag about a certain teacher that had to quit because the class was so bad they ruined the teacher. The teacher had to quit. They brag about it. What? Right? That's not personal. Just business, right? The thing is that. So we see their niceness is really not nice. It's not thought out, but it's just based on the society, and they would carry out the evil if they could bypass that guilt that stops them. Wherever their guilt stops them, that's where they can't go on, you see. So the thing is, if they could bypass the guilt, they definitely do evil. In other words, when a teacher is nice and he wants to back off, the student doesn't take that as niceness, the student takes that as weakness, and therefore they attack. No, that's 100% true. I'll tell you why. I mean, I've experimented many times. When I started out teaching, I made mistakes. I would punish a kid, then the kid would really cry. And I feel sorry for the guy. The guy was twice as bad as soon as I gave in. Twice as bad. Always. That is not really niceness, though, that you are nice. It's just your guilt that controls you. If you didn't have that guilt, if a human being couldn't be trained, then he would totally be evil. But we can't be trained. So therefore we control our evil, but the training does not stop evil. The question is about kindness. They don't get how the kindness, the last step, the last part of the development. I'll try and give an example. When Moshe killed the Egyptian, and then the next day he reprimanded the Jews, so the Jews attacked him and says, what, are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptians? He said, therefore the thing is known. So the first explanation in Rashi is that it's known to the king and I better run away because my life is in danger. But Rashi has a second explanation, and he says that now it's known that these people don't want help. They don't want to be helped. And therefore, there's no reason for me to be... If a person doesn't want help, there's no justice to help them, and he left. He went away, okay? And that's a true idea. The only thing is, by the burning bush, the Abarbanel explains the metaphor of the burning bush, says that the bush represents Israel, and they can never be destroyed. They are different than anybody else.
Really was the burning bush?
There is a burning bush, but however, there's an interpretation of why God appeared to him in exactly that way. And the answer is because one of the explanations of the Abarbanel is the tree represents Israel, and the fire represents, that it can't be destroyed, that Israel cannot be destroyed, that the God relates to Israel different than any other nation. And even though they really don't deserve to be helped, but however, it's God's will that they should be helped. You see? When you recognize the total system, you see, and especially you recognize God, you recognize God's will, so then that is that becomes your reality, that you must help the individual. Now there's two types of help. One type of help is if the person wants to be helped. Then you have to know when you have obligated to help a person, even when he doesn't want to be helped. That you have to know when. That was God telling Moshe, in this case, you have to help them. So the thing is that's why you see you have to be a chacham, you have to be a thinker, to know when to help a person. But as you relate to God, you see, then you understand God's will, and because it's God's will to help people and to relate to people, therefore, you want to relate to people. See, the first level of the tzaddik is the person that recognizes that he's part of a system, but not the particular individual. In other words, he looks at you just like a system of justice. If I owe you money, I have to pay you back. It doesn't matter who you are. And you will have to pay me back because you owe me money. It's just like, that's it, we're just part of a system. The chassid recognizes the individual, that it's God's will that you recognize the individual and try to help the individual. You see? Because that's God's will. That's what you see from the universe and from studying the universe and from studying the Torah. Definitely. Through prophecy, you definitely see that. The thing is that, like, for instance, the question is, how do you see it through the universe? You do see, like Einstein, after he got through with his theory, you see he started helping, even though he wasn't a religious man, he worked for Israel, he felt that he should do that. He wasn't in his own world, he went out to be nice to others. I can't explain exactly how it works, but it seems to be that through the study of the universe, it seems to affect you. But definitely through the prophecy of the Torah, you see that it's God's will to be kind, And when ideas become real to you, so when it becomes real, that becomes your philosophy, therefore you should be kind to others. So your kindness to others comes via your philosophy, but via your relationship to God. You see? That's how you truly relate to people in a kind way. Because it's God's will, and then you're a chacham, so therefore you know when to help people and when not to help people and exactly how to help people. That's the chassid. But it comes via God. The question is, why should I help a person, you see? So, from your personal point of view, yeah, because especially, let's say, for instance, you're a chacham. You're a chacham, what's the benefit in it for me? If there's a benefit, then I'll do it. If there's no benefit, why should I do it? You see? But if the benefit is, once you start living by your mind and you study Torah and you see that the Torah, that God wants you to be kind, so that becomes your philosophy. That becomes your philosophy via God. So therefore helping people is via God. The thing is that there is a benefit in being kind, even from the emotional standpoint, and that it is easier to, when you develop and you start seeing the truth, so then you don't have to change your actions, and you could live by your ideas. The only thing is you clarify what actions you should do and what you shouldn't do. But if you're a evil person, if you're not really kind at all, you don't have that training to be kind to others at all, so then it's practically impossible to change, because all your emotions and all your actions is to hurt people. Then it becomes a very difficult thing to change, because then you have to really change every action. I'm not saying it's impossible. It is possible, but it's much harder, much harder. So therefore, even though our kindness is only guilt, but it's still better, it's still a good thing, it's still, because it starts us off on that area of being kind, so when we see it rationally, it becomes easier to live that life. That's why we train our children to keep Torah, even though they don't understand it. Because if they're keeping it according to their emotions, then later on, when they see it rationally, they just have to change their emotions in line with the rational. But if you're not living the life of Torah, it's not easy, but the other way is much harder. If you're not living the life of Torah, and then you have to change everything, even the way you feel and the way every aspect of your life, it's much, much harder. Well, verse 20, and it says that trustworthy man has many blessings, and he who rushes to wealth will not be innocent. Hey, the first thing is we want to say that if you're goal-oriented, if you rush to wealth, means that you are goal-oriented, so then the means will not be important to you, so therefore you could be unjust and do any types of means. Now the question is, what does it mean one has many blessings and one will not be innocent? So not be innocent, that we explained, that he will find his means, since he's goal-oriented, his means will be anything that he wants. Okay? But what does it mean the trustworthy person has many blessings? Al Capone was one time walking with a friend. Yeah, Al Capone, the criminal, right? Was one time walking with his friend. They walked past the house where the drapes were open, and the guy said, like, people could live with their drapes open, like it was an amazing thing, that they weren't afraid of the drapes open, because they were constantly afraid that somebody was going to shoot in. They're constantly afraid. In other words, you can't see inside, so therefore you can't be shot. But if your window is open, you're afraid. You constantly have a fear of being shot at. There was another crime boss, I don't remember his name, but he said that he could have made as much money legally without all the complications of being on the run. It's just a matter of working it out. In other words, running a crime syndicate takes the same amount of energy, more energy, because you also have to worry about the law and all that, and you have to watch your back against people that want to take over. So he says he could have made the same thing. He could have done the same thing in a legal way if he put all his energy into a legal way. So I think what he means by many blessings, it means that he doesn't have the negative of the life of crime. In the life of crime, it affects your life in a very, very negative manner. You have to constantly be watching your back. And you see from both these stories that constantly, it's a constant pain, there's a constant bother, the way they live their life. It's not a secure life, very insecure life, you see. And it's because of that that I think that it says many blessings are to the trustworthy person. And there could be other blessings, but I think this is a clear benefit in being an honest person. In other words, let's say, for instance, when a person is on the bottom rung of a crime syndicate, right, a crime family, so the way he works up, he kills the person in front of him. And on top is not going to let him get ahead of him by just because he's working harder. If he sees somebody catching up to him, he'll kill him, because he wants to protect his place. That when you reach the top and there's no place else to go, then the only thing that's left is watching your back. There is nothing else. The life of the insecurity. In other words, you're insecure from other mobsters. You're insecure from the people in your own family, your own syndicate, and you're insecure from the police. In fact, the police is probably the least of your problems. In other words, you might have conflicts, but he's also human. He also has these conflicts, but his conflicts are not only within him, but they're also in reality. Your conflicts that you're afraid, I mean, you have fears. That's a natural thing. But however, it's not based on reality. I mean, you don't keep your drapes closed. You don't walk in a group with the guns and looking always behind your back, who might shoot you and who might be turning against you. You don't have that. You might have fears, but it's not based, not reality based. Like they have also the regular fears, but by them it's reality based. Verse 21, he who recognizes a friend is not good, and for a piece of bread a person will sin. They're talking about a judge. All the commentaries say we're talking about a judge. And in court, if he recognizes a friend, so the Matzudas Dabit says that that's not good, because the other person will feel insecure, and when he gives his claims, so he won't be secure when he gives his claims, because he feels the judge is going to listen to his friend over the other guy. The other guy feels insecure. And on a piece of bread, in other words, on a very small thing, a judge can change the law. In other words, on a very small... In other words, the first is when I recognize the friend. And the second is that I accept the bribe. The smallest type of bribe could affect my action. In other words, the first one undermines the other person. See, the first one undermines the other person. The second one affects the judge, that the judge will change his judgment. Okay? And this is what I got from the Matzudas Dabit. But I would like to say that this verse also would apply in everyday life, besides by a judge. Okay? And I'd like to ask, how is that? I think what it means is that there are two ways that your judgment is affected. Every day you have to make decisions whether something is right or wrong. You're making decisions. whether you should do something, whether you shouldn't do something, whether or right or wrong. Now, the thing is, there's two things that affect your judgment. One, what affects your judgment if you hold somebody as a friend, so then you'll look at it in a very different light than you look at the situation in a very different light than it was two people that you don't know. If you're objective, then you just look at the situation, in this situation, who is right and who is wrong, you see? But once you have a friend involved, that will affect your judgment, and you'll lean more towards one over the other. You lean towards one over the other, and it'll affect your judgment. You won't judge on the act, but you'll judge based on who's your friend and who's not. Okay? And two, if somebody is nice to you, even if you don't know them, they're nice to you, that could also affect your judgment. Because, in other words, you'll lean more towards the person that is kind or nice to you more than the other person. They're saying there's two things that affect your judgment when you have to make a decision in a certain situation where there's people involved, other people involved. There's two things which could affect your judgment. I mean, first you have to be a person that thinks objectively and tries to make decisions based on an objective, based on the fact that happened, not who the person is, but just objectively what the situation is, you see? But there's two things that could affect the decision, and that is if one of the people involved is a friend, or one of the people involved is nice to you or does a kind act for you, then it will affect your judgment. Hey, the question is, what is a bribe? The bribe is, in other words, in our case that we're talking about, a bribe is where somebody, it doesn't have to be intentional, but they are doing you something that you consider a favor. Something that you would consider as a favor. I don't care if that's his purpose is to bribe you or not, but that's what he is doing. At that moment, you feel a certain amount of drawn towards the person. Like, for instance, that might be more beneficial when your parents reprimand you or punish you. Might be more beneficial for your life. But yet, at that moment, you don't feel friendly towards them. But however, if they buy you something or they give you something, then you, at that time, you feel... So you feel that they're special, they're better, and you'll judge them differently than when they're doing maybe something that's good for you, even though you consider it a punishment. You see? The question is that there's sometimes when somebody gives you a present, so the thing is you feel an obligation to give them back a present. Okay? And we'd like to try to understand what's the difference between where you receive a present and you feel that you accept the present totally, or where you feel a sense of obligation towards the person, if that makes a difference, and if that make a difference in this situation. Hey, well, we're still in chapter 28, verse 22. It says, "He who is quick for wealth, he has an evil eye, and he does not know that a loss will come." The first thing is quick for money. The commentaries say that it's greed or stinginess. The Rabbag in particular says it's greed or stinginess. Okay? That's how people assume to that they'll get money quick. Ra'ayin, evil eye, means that, in other words, when he looks at others that have anything, he looks at them in a negative way. In other words, the nature of the stingy or greed is such that when somebody else has something, it's close to jealousy, but it comes out in money. That that if anybody has something, he's always, greed is always trying to accumulate more and more money. Stingy means I can't spend it. In other words, I can't tolerate to spend it. And it's usually in other words, an evil eye, I think according to the Pasuk, means that he looks at the world in a negative way. In a negative way. In other words, when a person is, in other words, they don't look at life in a realistic manner. Everything is negative. Whatever, they can't tolerate where other people have things. You see? In other words, where they're constantly for themselves, and what they don't have, it bothers them. So therefore, when they see others have, so it bothers them that others have, and it causes them to have a negative view of people. And it could cause them to have a negative view of life in general. Now then it says, the second half says, in other words, this must be the cause of why he doesn't know that a loss is coming. A loss will become. So what is the loss? And what prevents him from knowing? There must be something in the Ayin Hara. Must be something in the Ayin Hara, the evil eye that stops him. I think the failure could come out in many ways. Thomas wants to say one way is that since he feels that everything is his, everything should be his, and he wants all this money, he's grateful for all this money, he cannot see any type of failure, that if he makes a mistake, he can't accept that type of failure. He must see, that's what Ayin Hara means, that I look at others, I blame others, and it's their fault. In other words, also, it's their fault for my mistakes. In other words, anything that goes wrong, they have somebody to blame. They look at others in a negative, very negative view. You see, the best way of recognizing Ayin Hara is through probably Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is a very negative view of people. You see, same type of thing. Also, a person that's extremely greedy or stingy, most people don't like. When it really to an extreme, people don't like, they lose a lot of friendships. It's a loss of their social life. That's definitely a loss. And also the loss is a general unhappiness because everything is negative. Everything the person looks at as negative is definitely not a happy life. So he's also lacking in that way also. So he's lacking in many, many ways, but he doesn't even realize it. He thinks his life is the best life. He doesn't realize it. Constantly he thinks that this is the only way to live. And he'll look down on anybody that lives a different type of life. In other words, I'm not saying that he has, that he has a good life. He thinks consciously that his life is the best life. But unconsciously might be extreme. He definitely is an unhappy person. That's why he's constantly negative. That definitely shows unhappiness, but he wouldn't accept that he is unhappy. Definitely the guy is unhappy, that's why he's constantly driven towards either saving money or making money. He's constantly driven, it's constantly on his mind. We're talking about an extreme case here. And the guy is constantly driven for this. So therefore, definitely that shows that the guy is unhappy. But that guy doesn't recognize, because of his being driven, he's constantly moving, he does not give himself time to recognize that he is unhappy. Thomas disagrees and knows that the guy is consciously aware that he is unhappy. I just want to make a distinction between Thomas and I, and that is that Thomas, I think, is thinking in terms of a person that has the ability to be aware of himself and be aware of his desires and aware that that is a shortcoming. But however, a person that is driven cannot think about himself. He's too busy being driven at that moment. At that moment when he's being driven, he is not aware of himself. In other words, the guy is unhappy, but he fakes, that's what's driving him, you see. But just like at a party, a person works for making a party and they feel good about it, even though the activity is not pleasurable, for the excitement of what's going to happen, you see. The same thing with him. He's so busy with the excitement of what's going to happen, he doesn't notice the pain. He doesn't notice that he's being driven by something, and that drive is the fact that he'll always be unhappy. But his mind is what I will get, what I'm going to get. And so therefore, since his mind is what he's going to get, he fakes himself out, and he must constantly be driven to get these things, even though he's totally unhappy. But he doesn't recognize this unhappiness, so he's driven for these things. There was a statistics on TV that they said that 50% of the of all the women that have implants, 50% of suicides among women are more by women that have implants. So they said the reason is because they have a bad self-image. So the thing is, you see, people are driven by these unconscious desires, by like a bad self-image, and they're driven for things, and they think the physical world can satisfy them, but it really cannot satisfy them. You see? The same thing with money. There's some negative unconscious drive that's driving him for money. And that drive can never be satisfied by the making of money. By making of money. That's impossible. And therefore, the only way to deal with it is to deal with the problem itself. That's the only way of dealing with it. But trying to straighten it out in the physical world will not work. That is the real loss that most people don't realize. That's the loss what I believe the Pasuk is talking about. That very drive is a loss. He doesn't even realize that that is the loss. The real gain would be if he could just turn around and say, what's driving me to get this place, to get wherever I'm going? That would be the gain.